This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You're encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information, and we answer all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this Saturday morning, February 1st. And as we enter into another month, we see a lot of different topics coming up. For example, the month of February being a heart healthy month. And it also coincides with the big national meeting for cardiovascular disease that's being held in California this year. But apropos to that, our guest today is going to be Dr. Joseph DeSimone. Dr. DeSimone is a cardiac surgeon at Trinity Health of New England. And he's got a lot of information for us. Now, you'll recall in the past we talked about heart transplantation. Primarily what we're going to be talking about with Dr. DeSimone is repairing the heart and the valves and what makes it work. So it's going to be interesting. You know, before I do these shows, I like to talk to my guest and find out a little something. I've never met Dr. DeSimone, but out of interest, he was born at St. Francis Hospital and is now back working at St. Francis Hospital. I really like when I hear accomplished physicians staying in Connecticut or coming back to Connecticut. And I think I'm seeing more and more of it. You know, there's been a bit of there's been a bit of a problem here with medical malpractice, things that are difficult to practice in. It's not the best practice environment, let's put it that way. But I think that many people have found that it's a great area to bring up your children, and it offers a lot of advantages, especially with major medical centers like Hartford Hospital, St. Francis, UConn, Yale. So, again, we're going to be chatting with him a little bit later on in the show. This day in medicine, February 1st, there are a couple of things I wanted to mention. It's the Feast of St. Brigid of Ireland. Now, St. Brigid actually practiced medicine and midwifery. So she was a midwife, practiced medicine. And now we're talking about 453. She lived from 453 to 525. And so you can see how far back that was. But what was also interesting was she advocated for the rulers at the time, the people who were ruling, to banish people who were quacks. Very interesting, because even back then, we were dealing with people who were charlatans and taking advantage of people. So anyhow, we remember St. Brigid today of Ireland, a very big saint. And actually, she was baptized by St. Patrick. So it was interesting to check up on that. But this same day, February 1st in 1941, it was the first attempt to use penicillin. And they were using it to treat an advanced staphylococcus infection in an individual. Unfortunately, the patient died. And the reason they died was because there wasn't enough penicillin. It was such a limited supply of the experimental drug, and they ran out of it. So that was in 1941. I think we always think that we've had these antibiotics for much longer than that. And the fact that it was 1941 is not that long ago when you think of the saving power of antibiotics. Some of the other things that came up, I wanted to cover a few topics, but there was a study at the University of Michigan looking at exercise in cancer risk and while people were having cancer treatment. And I thought that was interesting because they really looked at it from that standpoint of during treatment, can you be more successful with that treatment by exercising? And the exercise was pretty simple. I mean, you just start off with a brisk walk. And it's so important for us to get out and exercise, even in this kind of weather. Just getting out to walk and exercise makes a big difference. And they have documented that you lower your risk for developing cancer. And if you have cancer, it leads to a better outcome. So again, more and more support for the use of exercise medicinally, basically. Also, you have the social support. If you're out there with friends who also are like-minded and want to get out there and walk, that social aspect is key in many situations. You know, lately we've been hearing a lot about diversity and equity and inclusion. But, you know, everybody kind of lumps that all together. And there are certain situations in medicine where looking at performing equity studies becomes crucial. And the reason why is because we have a limited amount of money, right? So we have a health budget. And the question becomes, what treatments do you use in what populations, right? Because not everybody is genetically the same, and some people are more prone to things. In this particular case that I reviewed was a study of health equity in Alzheimer's disease. And looking at it in an African-American population. But we do equity studies all the time on women. For example, you know, it wasn't until we did equity studies in women as part of the Framingham study that we found out that after menopause, women are more susceptible to heart disease. So again, when we hear these equity studies, it's not something that we should automatically say, oh, this can't be good, we should ban this or whatever. When it comes to science, these equity studies have really helped us a great deal. The other thing is this, you know, it's sports season, and you know I work with a lot of athletes, but here in Connecticut, we have a dramatic shortage of athletic trainers. And athletic trainers, if you look at injury and specifically concussion, we found that schools that had athletic trainers were more likely to achieve a correct diagnosis of a head injury and a faster recovery from that head injury. And that applies really to all injuries when you think about it. So what does it take to become an athletic trainer? And this is a field that has evolved. I studied athletic training while I was in high school and college. It was a mail order course, basically, whereas now it's a master's level course. And the courses here in Connecticut are at UConn, Sacred Heart, Central Connecticut, and Southern Connecticut State Universities. That's it, right? So you have four programs to try and train athletic trainers. And athletic training, it's a hard job. I mean, they are the link between the physician and the athlete. They know these athletes. They know them very well. And, you know, they work ungodly hours, a lot of weekend work. Average salary is between $48,000 and $56,000. And again, don't forget, you're graduating with a lot of loans. So it's become a real issue here at the high school level in order to provide athletic trainers. And a lot of people, we try to develop programs to get more athletic trainers involved. But we're looking at it from the standpoint of high schools. So don't forget, there are a lot of other levels, right? We have all these AAU travel teams, things such as that. And it's important to have athletic trainers as part of the treatment and the safety of a sport. People always ask me when they go look at a school, right? People are looking at a high school for their child who may be somewhat gifted in athletics and is want to go to a school where they would prosper in terms of the athletic facility. And they always ask me, well, what do you recommend asking? And I recommend asking, do you have a full-time athletic trainer? That's the key. Is there a full-time athletic trainer involved in your program? Because that demonstrates that that institution is willing to invest in the safety of their athletes. So again, we really need to develop. There's a task force now here in Connecticut to try and see how we can attract athletic trainers to stay here if they're training in our programs, or attract others to come here. But it's a field that when you talk to them, it's really a vocation. These people are just so devoted to these athletes, and they really develops a family atmosphere more than anything. One other thing. So we're hearing a lot about the flu this year, right? The flu has really dominated the illnesses we're seeing. COVID is not as bad this winter, but you have to understand COVID is not a seasonal disease, right? So when you contract COVID, it's there in the spring and summer. What we've found this year, and I think it's because, you know, there's been so much with vaccination for COVID that it's a much more muted strain. And the COVID that's out there has not really raised a lot of hospitalizations. But as you remember, one of the ways that we know if COVID is running rampant is by looking at wastewater. Wastewater still offers the best window into COVID being in a particular population. What we are seeing more, and I think I've seen a lot of this, is walking pneumonia, basically RSV. We're seeing a lot of norovirus, and now we're dealing with a bird flu. And fortunately, it hasn't really taken hold here in the Northeast, but we're seeing that among various populations of fowl. So important to note, but again, be on the lookout. For these few months, I have asked patients to wear masks, and I wear a mask in the exam room. I'm going to be there a while. We get very close to each other, and I'm happy to say no one, actually, several people just went out of their way to say thank you, and thank you for thinking of me and trying to protect me. I mean, when you go to a health facility to see a doctor, guess what? There are sick people there, so you don't necessarily want to take too many chances. So it's been interesting to see that people who have adapted to it, if you're going to be in a closed situation, elevator, on a bus for a long time, you'll want to wear a mask. All right, we're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. Joseph DeSimone. We're talking about cardiovascular disease. Now, if you want to get in touch with me, the best way to do that is by going to info@alessimd.com, and I'm happy to ask questions of Dr. DeSimone while he's on the air or later on. So with that, we'll take a short break. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. And it's great to be with you on this Saturday morning and with my guest today, Dr. Joseph DeSimone, who is a cardiac surgeon at Trinity Health of New England, and specifically he is at St. Francis Hospital. And Joe, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So, Joe, we had such a great discussion yesterday about really your roots being right here in West Hartford. Can you share some of that with our listeners?
Certainly. Thank you for having me on. And I did enjoy talking to you last night. One of the first things, just as an aside, I am from West Hartford, Connecticut, and I realize we're on WTIC, and I had this moment this morning where I was remembering as a kid when it would snow out in the winter and we would want our parents to turn on WTIC, hoping beyond hope that we would hear that school was canceled. That's my memory of WTIC. It was the school cancellation. Anyway, I'm from West Hartford. I was actually born here. I was born at St. Francis Hospital. I recently returned to be a heart surgeon here. I went to Notre Dame out in Indiana, returned back for medical school at University of Connecticut. I did my general surgery training up at Dartmouth-Hitchcock, went on to my cardiac surgery training at Johns Hopkins, and I've been in practice for 17 years, and I'm having somewhat of a homecoming back here in Hartford.
Well, it's great. It's great to have accomplished people like you come back to our state. When we think of cardiovascular disease, can you frame the problem? Because it's really interesting in terms of the numbers and how we're doing. Can you talk a little bit about some of those statistics?
So I think sometimes when people hear it over and over again, we might get a little numb to it. But it's actually quite simple in terms of framing it. It is the leading cause of death in the United States. It is roughly, heart disease as a total is about 20%, even higher, of all deaths in the United States. If you were to compare cancer deaths and heart deaths, if you were to take all cancers, heart deaths exceed the number of total cancer deaths in the United States. And I think seeing it that way, and as we talk, maybe we can get into the little details of each individual subsegment of what is involved in heart disease. But I think that is the most poignant kind of bullet point you can say about heart disease. And isn't it interesting that here we are on February 1st, Heart Month, talking about this?
Well, I think it's just striking from that standpoint, because we want to get into talking a little bit about the risks and things such as that. And also, you know, one of the things we talked about yesterday, and I already have a question here from Lori to take care of. We want to talk about the calcium score and things such as that. But when we look at the risk factors for heart disease, what would you say is the biggest risk factor right now that we have to deal with?
I don't think I would want to point to one thing for the biggest risk factor. I think it is what we inherit and what we do to ourselves. So there is our genetics, our hypertension, obesity, our physical inactivity, smoking. It is those things, and it is always those things.
Yeah, absolutely. And so many of them are modifiable risk factors. I mean, you're not going to change your genetics, but the other things you mentioned are things that can be modified, and I think that's key.
In concert with medicine, yes.
Absolutely. We're going to take a short break. They're going to be back. If you have more questions for me, I'm going to pose Lori's question for Dr. DeSimone. You could reach me at info@alessimd.com. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be on with my guest today, Dr. Joseph DeSimone, who is a cardiac surgeon at St. Francis Hospital. If you wish to reach out to Dr. DeSimone, his office number is 860-714-1094. Joe, the question came in, and actually it was one of the ones we were about to discuss from Lori, and basically it's about the cardiac calcium scan and who should be having this, how useful is it. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. A cardiac CAT scan calcium score. This is a CAT scan without the use of drinking anything or anything going into your IV. It is just a fancy X-ray in the CAT scan, and it is used by physicians to as an aid to help stratify patients' risk for coronary disease. So when you go into the CAT scanner and have your CAT scan done, what the CAT scan is doing is it's looking at the amount of calcium that is built up on someone's coronary arteries. These are the arteries that supply blood and oxygen to the heart. And when you go through that CAT scanner, then a score is formed, a higher score, more calcium, a lower score, less calcium. And by having that done, that will help your doctor, your cardiologist, help stratify you, figure out, are you someone who is higher risk and need a different type of medicine or less medicine or even another test further that goes with your family history, your age, what medicines you're on, what your cholesterol level is. And it's just one more piece of information that helps figure out, okay, what is the next step in preventing a heart attack?
You know, I find it interesting because it's such a useful test and doing more and more of it. But insurance, I don't know if any insurance company pays for it. It's you have to pay out of pocket for the most part. I know most facilities charge $100 for the scan itself. Do you know, has that changed? Are more companies paying for it now, Medicare? Or
From the research that I've done, I cannot find where it is covered. It seems that most places I've read that it is pay out of pocket right now. And right now, the American College of Cardiologists have come out and stated that this is an excellent cardiovascular disease risk marker using this test. So I would imagine that something like this is going to change in the future in terms of coverage.
Could we take a look then? You mentioned the calcium score, but what about CT angio of the heart, where you're actually looking at the blood vessels? Is that a useful test now? Do you do much of that?
I would say, as a cardiac surgeon, when the coronary arteries, those blood vessels that we're talking about, need to be looked at. And if you're coming in for a surgery, whether that's a bypass surgery, a surgery of your aorta, a surgery of your valves, that test is not a test that I use frequently. Patients who end up needing a heart operation most of the time are still going to need a cardiac catheterization, and that is the more invasive test in which you come in and the interventional cardiologist is actually going to take pictures of your coronary arteries. The coronary angiogram that can be done through the use of the CAT scanner does have its utilization, but it's less frequent in what I do.
Okay. Let's get into something that you do, and that is cardiac valvular disease. Can you talk a little bit about the causes and treatments of valvular disease in the heart? Because we're hearing more and more about that. I'm always hearing patients who have, a leaky valve. It's been, and is it something related to age? Just can you give us some background on this one?
So far and away, the coronary disease and the stents and the bypass are what almost all heart surgeons see the most frequently, and then the next being the valve disease. And within the area of valvular disease, if you were to say which is the most frequent we see to the least frequent, because there are four valves in the heart, is the aortic valve, which is an outlet. So when the heart pumps, the aortic valve opens. And that, by far and away, is what we're going to see the most. And that aortic valve either doesn't open properly, that's aortic stenosis, a narrowing of the aortic valve. Frequently, we see that in an aging population, similar to the way that we see coronary artery disease. The valve becomes calcified and stiff and doesn't open. There's another portion of aortic valve disease where people are born with an aortic valve that doesn't have the same number of leaflets opening and closing. They might be born with most commonly two leaflets that open and close. And those valves can have their own subset of problems, early narrowing or even leaking of that. That's the aortic valve. And then patients have a choice of intervention on that. There's the catheter-based stent valve, which is the TAVR, which people have probably heard of, and then there's the surgical valve replacement. As far as the next most frequent valve that we operate on and see that needs therapy, and that would be the mitral valve. And I think for our purposes, the mitral valve is the inlet. That is when oxygenated red blood is coming back from your lungs into the heart, and it's ready to be pumped out of the aortic valve to give oxygen and blood to your body. That valve needs to open and allow the heart to fill, and it has to close properly to allow the blood to move in one direction out the aortic valve. That valve, much more commonly, which we see, is a leakiness of that valve, mitral valve regurgitation. Some people might have mitral valve prolapse. And then there are a whole host of other things. And in that circumstance, again, there's a non-surgical intervention, that is the mitral clip, and then there's the surgical intervention, which is the mitral valve repair. Again, we see quite a bit of that, and people who need mitral valve repairs, and then all of the details involved in how you do a mitral valve repair. Thirdly, which I'll just touch on, is the tricuspid valve. And that valve largely is repaired, and we frequently see it concomitantly when someone is here for a mitral valve repair. The tricuspid may also need something done to it, largely a repair.
When you say repair, now, it used to be they put the old there was a metal valve that would go in. I remember it from med school. You'd hear it clicking, and things like that. Then there are porcine valves. So when you say repair it, are you replacing the valve?
So with any type of valve repair, what you're doing is you're taking the patient's own valve and you are trying to restore the anatomy of their own valve so that they keep their own valve and it functions normally. So that's in a regurgitant valve. So let's just take the mitral valve for the purposes of this. So if someone has mitral valve prolapse that's gotten to the point where either portions of the valve are bending backwards or have broken or have become so thickened and distorted, there are multiple ways where you save that valve. They keep their valve, and you try to bring that anatomy back to a part, back to a point where it functions normally. And there are many ways of doing that. There are ways of taking out pieces of the valve. There are ways of reconstructing the valve using Gore-Tex to reconstruct their heart strings. And then on top of that, there is a ring that gets sewn on to the valve, which restores the correct diameter of the valve.
What are the symptoms? In other words, if someone is suspected of having valvular disease, what kind of symptoms would they present with?
So people who come for a valve repair would fall into two categories. Let's start with the symptoms, and then we'll go to the patients who don't have symptoms.
Sure.
Symptoms of valvular disease start off with shortness of breath. Shortness of breath can be broken down into a very long discussion of, is it shortness of breath when you're sitting still, or is it something called dyspnea on exertion, which is shortness of breath when you try to go do something. Then there is feelings of lightheadedness. There's chest discomfort, pressure, tightness, overall fatigue. Can you still do what you normally do? Have you subconsciously eased off on walking up the stairs or doing the physical activities that you do because you become either too short of breath or just too fatigued when you do it? Those are the common symptoms. Then there are also palpitations, which could be a symptom of an irregular heartbeat associated with your valvular problems. Then there's the whole group of people who have a murmur and are seeing their doctor and doing the right thing and getting an echocardiogram. And they are found to have possibly a leaky mitral valve but don't have symptoms. And the changes that can go on in some patients who just don't feel it.
I have a question that just came in, Joe. I wanted to run by you. Now, this is an interesting one. This is from Patricia. She asks, with no history or symptoms, is there a need for a baseline EKG? And if so, at what age? Because her PCP said there's no need to do an EKG.
The best way I can answer the question is that an EKG is not a screening test. The best screening for heart disease is a history and physical. Symptoms, family history, murmurs, checking your cholesterol, making sure your glucose and your A1C, you don't have diabetes, reviewing a smoking history. Those are far and away a better source of detection than a snapshot in time of several seconds of your heartbeat. That's not to say an EKG is not a good test. It's an excellent tool that we have, but as an overall screening test, in my experience, it wouldn't be as worthwhile as seeing your doctor and going over your family history and everything I outlined.
Okay. That's important. I hope that answers it. Because I know, for example, my physician, when I go for my annual check, he does everything, blood work, and he adds an EKG.
And that's perfectly fine.
Yeah, and I feel better about it, actually.
In no way would I ever discourage it. An EKG is a great test.
Let's talk about bypass versus angioplasty. Because, as you mentioned, it's the most common procedure that you're performing these days, and how that's evolved with over time in doing those procedures.
So as far as coronary artery bypass grafting, or some people who've had a family member have had it or have had it themselves, they've heard it referred to as CABG surgery, C-A-B-G, and that versus angioplasty, which evolved to coronary stenting, also known as PCI. Mm-hmm. Okay. And what I guess I would love to say about that, and hopefully I'm answering the question, is these two procedures often are seen as in opposition to each other. And what I would encourage people to understand is think of them as in concert. There is a wide spectrum of how people present with their heart disease, with their coronary disease, all the way from having a heart attack, 911, going straight to the catheterization lab and getting a stent emergently to halt that heart attack, all the way down to patients who are having stable symptoms. Maybe they've had a coronary calcium score and have ultimately had a catheterization and have multivessel disease. When it comes to having stenting or bypass surgery, what goes into it and the decision that needs to be made from your heart team and the patient as well is your presentation, your anatomy, and then all those other things that are risk factors that go into the risk-benefit of should you have surgery, should you just take medicine, should you have a stent, because there's not only your heart, there's the rest of you that has to tolerate whatever intervention we're doing to you. As far as the innovations in bypass surgery, these innovations range anywhere from the solution that we use in the operating room to preserve your heart while it's stopped, while we're doing the procedure. Then there are those groups of surgeons that will do the surgery while the heart is beating. There are innovations in terms of the increased use of arteries that live underneath your chest and in your forearm, to use these as bypasses in addition to the vein. And for those people who don't know, when we bypass a blockage, we take a blood vessel from somewhere else in your body and we reroute the blood around the blockage versus the stent, which is going to go right at the blockage, balloon it open, and then the stent acts as a cage or a culvert to hold that narrowing open. So I guess those would be some of many innovations that have occurred since the late 60s in bypass surgery.
Well, it's fascinating at how far it's come. One of the things we're hearing about, and a lot of these, you know, now that we see people advertising on TV and things that really need to be clarified, one of those I find interesting is the use of the Watchman procedure for atrial fibrillation. Can you talk a little bit about that procedure and how that, and is it effective?
So first of all, atrial fibrillation, and I'll try to be quick here.
Sure.
Just big numbers. Globally, over 50 million people in the world are living with atrial fibrillation. Over 10 million people in the United States experience atrial fibrillation. The Watchman is not, it's not a procedure that takes care of the atrial fibrillation. Atrial fibrillation is associated with many other things that can go on because of the atrial fibrillation. One of the big things is stroke. In someone who has atrial fibrillation, clot, coagulated blood, can build up in the left atrial appendage. And if that were to break off and go to the brain, you would have a stroke. And what the Watchman is designed for and is effective at, there's a lot of detail to it. And my cardiology, specifically interventional cardiology, but even more specifically the electrophysiologists, have this device called the Watchman. And the Watchman is a device that gets inserted into the left atrial appendage, thereby plugging off the left atrial appendage, and kind of over time you seal it off and form a smooth surface so that the need for blood thinners and the risks of taking a lifetime of blood thinners is avoided to help reduce the risk of stroke. As far as the details of those studies, these are very nuanced studies, and what I would say is the Watchman is effective. It would be a discussion for each individual to have with their cardiologist and most likely with an electrophysiologist about are they ideal for the Watchman. In one line, what it would be is the Watchman is probably most ideal for those patients who have AFib and can't take a blood thinner or for whatever reasons are unwilling to take a blood thinner.
Okay, I think that's an important summary from that standpoint. When we talked about those numbers that you brought up about atrial fibrillation, I found that interesting, with more than 10 million people in the U.S. with it. Is it an age-related issue? Are we more likely, is it because we're living longer that we're seeing more of it?
I don't know the exact answer to your question there. It certainly is age-related. There are different types of atrial fibrillation, those related to valvular disease. There is atrial fibrillation that is not related to valvular disease, that is inherited. I think it is age-related, but there are, it is more complex than that. How about I'll leave it at that?
Absolutely. Good way to put it. One other topic I wanted to get on, we have a couple of minutes left, is obstructive hypertensive cardiomyopathy.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that, what that is, and what it means?
So hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, HCM, and then hypertrophic obstructive cardiomyopathy, which is HOCM, which some people call HOCM. I would think that people have probably now are starting to hear about this a bit more because of commercials on the TV because of a specific drug called Camzyos, otherwise known as mavacamten. And this is the first medicine to be out commercially for a treatment of this. And what I would say is this is an inherited genetic-based abnormal thickening of the chamber of the heart. And that abnormal thickening of the heart can reduce the ability of the heart to take in the blood that it needs to pump out. And moreover, when the heart goes to pump the blood out, it can over-squeeze and obstruct the blood from trying to be ejected out of the heart. And my interest in HOCM, or HCM, is the surgical treatment for it, which is the myectomy. Going into the operating room, looking through the aortic valve, and shaving out the muscle that is abnormally thickened in the septum of the heart, allowing the blood to flow out of the heart properly, reducing and abating any of the symptoms. But there are other therapies. This isn't just about surgery. There's now a medicine that is effective, and it's not for everybody, but it is an incredible medicine. It's this Camzyos. And again, this is something you would talk to your cardiologist about or even see a heart failure specialist about. And then there are also, the interventional cardiologists also have a catheter-based therapy for this that can also help. And again, this is a team discussion. It's not a us against them, but if we work together, there's a way that we can treat everybody for these things.
Joe, thank you very much. Thank you for your time today, and thank you for coming back home. Welcome home, and it's great to have you back in Connecticut helping our friends and neighbors. Thank you again.
Thank you so much, and Friday is Go Red Day.
Okay, we're going to keep that in mind.
That is National Awareness for Women's Cardiovascular Disease this Friday.
Great. Thank you very much for that reminder.
Many
thanks to our studio producer. Kevin Kors has been on the board. Jeff Chandler's in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. If you missed any part of today's program, you can get the Healthy Rounds podcast. Just download it at Audacy.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Next up on WTIC is going to be Law Talk with attorney John Matulis. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by Hartford HealthCare, Rachford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com. Till then, stay well.